Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine number 186. This is Jeff Riddle. I'm the pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And on this last day of 2020, today is December the 31st of 2020, I want to record this Word Magazine on the topic of, is Codex Sinaiticus a forgery? Codex Sinaiticus is considered to be one of the two oldest extant unsealed manuscripts of the Bible, including the New Testament. But the question is it authentic? Was it really written in the fourth century, or was it written as a sort of a forgery or a replica of an unsealed manuscript in later centuries, in the 19th century, as some have claimed? Earlier this week, back on Tuesday, on the 29th of December, I posted my book review of D.C. Parker's book on Codex Sinaiticus. Here it is. It's titled Codex Sinaiticus, subtitled The Story of the World's Oldest Bible. And this was published by the British Library and Hendrickson in 2010. My review of it, which I did post to the audio version of, was completed in 2012 in the journal American Theological Inquiry. And as I was rereading that, that review, I noted that it made passing reference to a discussion that Parker has on the allegation that was raised in the 19th century that this codex, Codex Sinaiticus, might in fact be a forgery created by a man named Constantine, and I sort of muffled the pronunciation of his last name. It's Simonides. I guess it could be Simonides or Simonides. I'll probably pronounce it Simonides. And Constantine Simonides was a man who was sort of a scholar of some sort, a dealer in manuscripts in the 19th century. He was Greek, and he lived from 1820 to 1890. And so Parker makes reference in this book, Codex Sinaiticus, The Story of the World's Oldest Bible, about this claim that this codex actually is not authentic. It doesn't date to the fourth century, but instead it was a creation of the 19th century and was passed off as something that was authentic. Well, if that claim is true, that would really be astounding, because Codex Sinaiticus and its publication and its dissemination, its study by modern scholars since the 19th century resulted in some significant changes to the modern critical text. So Codex Sinaiticus, along with Vaticanus, for example, is one of only two extant early unseals that support the so-called shorter ending of Mark, Mark ending at Mark 16:8. It also would be an early witness to the absence of the pericope adulteri, the woman taken adultery passage, and many other passages within the New Testament. And so it was embraced, assumed to be authentic. If the charge that it was a 19th century forgery is true, then that would greatly undermine a lot of the authority of some of the decisions made in the modern critical text. And therefore, many conservative, traditional men have seized upon that. And I think even more recently, there have been a number of a chorus of voices challenging Sinaiticus on this basis. And the question is this true? I'm a traditionalist, as you know. Certainly, if Sinaiticus was a forgery, it would support, buttress my defense of the received text to a certain degree. But is it true? And how do we adjudicate this? And that's really, I think, part of the challenge. I also decided to do this Word Magazine because I noticed on my YouTube subscription feed that there is a debate that's scheduled to take place in a couple of days In fact, on Sunday, on January the 3rd of 2021, on Josh Gibbs's Talking Christianity podcast, between James Knapp Jr. and Stephen Avery. And the topic that is listed for this debate is the world's oldest Bible is a replica, Simonides the Scribe. And I assume that Stephen Avery is going to be arguing the affirmative on that, that Sinaiticus is a forgery that was created by Constantine Simonides. And I'm assuming that James Knapp is going to be arguing the contrary, although, as I just said, because he supports essentially a version of the Byzantine text, if Sinaiticus were a forgery, it would probably buttress his position. But I'm assuming he's going to be arguing contrary to that. He's going to be arguing that it is from the 4th century, even if he doesn't accept it and its readings in various places. So, again, this just raised the question. I think probably when I read D.C. Parker's book, it came out in 2010. I read it and then wrote the review in 2012. So sometime in that period, I read the book for the first time. I think that was the first time I had ever read about or heard about the Simonides forgery challenge. So that was my introduction to it. And I don't count myself as an expert on this particular subject matter, the charge of Codex Sinaiticus being a forgery. But I thought it might be helpful in light of this upcoming debate and in light of the fact that I read the review and this whole subject was brought to mind again, to share with you a little bit of what others have written on this topic. And so that's what I would like to do in this episode. So let's just begin by looking at Wikipedia. A lot of people dog on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia should be, read with care. But, there are a lot of things that are correct on Wikipedia. So let me see if I can get this screen to cooperate. You're seeing right now the online version of Codex Sinaiticus. And yeah, let me call up now the Wikipedia page on Constantine Simonides. And so it says, it notes that Constantine Simonides was a paleographer and dealer of icons, known as a man of extensive learning with significant knowledge of manuscripts and, let's see if we can find it. My screen is blocking it. And miraculous calligraphy. He surpasses contemporaries in literary abilities. Some paleographers say that he was the most versatile forger of the 19th century. The charge of forgery is unsubstantiated. Again, so everything on Wikipedia should be taken with a grain of salt, but it's good for giving us a general introduction. So tells us that Constantine Simonides was a man of significant learning. He knew manuscripts. He was a dealer in them, but he was charged with forgery. Here's a little bit about his life. He was born on the small Greek island of Syme in the southeast Aegean Sea in 1820 or in 1824 and died in Egypt of a leprosy. Simonides lived in the monasteries on Mount Athos between 1839 and 1841 and again in 1852. So Mount Athos is that great a collection of Greek and Orthodox monasteries where there are many significant Christian manuscripts, including biblical manuscripts. And it is said that during this time that he was there, he acquired some of the biblical manuscripts that he later sold. He produced, it says, a lot of manuscripts ascribed to Hellenistic and the early Byzantine periods. He allegedly forged a number of documents and manuscripts and claimed they were the originals of the Gospel of Mark, as well as original manuscripts of poems of Homer. He sold some of these manuscripts to the king of Greece. Greek scholars exposed what some claimed to be forgeries quickly, and he left Greece and traveled from country to country with his manuscripts. He visited England between 1853 and 1855 and other European countries, and his literary activity was extraordinary. Some of his works were published in Moscow, Odessa, in England, and in Germany. He also wrote many other works which were never published. From 1843 until 1856, he offered manuscripts purporting to be of ancient origins for sale all over Europe. Frederick G. Kenyon writes that Simonides created, quote, a considerable sensation by producing quantities of Greek manuscripts professing to be of fabulous antiquity, such as a Homer in an almost prehistoric style of writing, a lost Egyptian historian, a copy of St. Matthew's Gospel on papyrus, written 15 years after the Ascension, and other portions of the New Testament dating from the first century. These productions were then exposed as forgeries, end quote. And that's from the scholar Frederick G. Kenyon. In 1854 and 1855, Simonides tried unsuccessfully to sell some manuscripts for the British Museum of the Bodleian Library. And the Bodleian Library, Thomas Phillips, was a less critical purchaser and bought for the Phillips Library at Cheltenham some manuscripts in 1855. He visited Berlin and Leipzig. He informed Wilhelm Dendorf that he owned a palimpsest of Uranus. On September 13 of 1862, in an article in The Guardian, this is apropos now to our topic, he claimed that he was the real author of Codex Sinaiticus, and that he wrote it in 1839. According to him, it was the one poor work of his youth. Now, this will be significant. We'll see a little bit later. If he was born in 1820, he would have been 19 years old when he produced this. If he was born in 1924, he would have only been 15 years old If he was born in 1820, he would have been 19. If he were born in 1824, he would have been only 15 years old. According to him, it was, again, the one poor work of his youth. According to Simonides, he visited Sinai in 1852 and saw the Codex. Henry Bradshaw, a scholar, did not believe his claims. Simonides questioned many official scientific positions accepted by scholars. He did not respect any scholars. He interpreted the Egyptian hieroglyphics in different ways from Champollion and the Egyptologists. He tried to prove that his method of interpreting Egyptian hieroglyphics was superior. He placed the death of Irenaeus at 292. Also, in many other complicated questions, he had his own usually controversial point of view. But after ascribing the authorship of the Codex Sinaiticus to himself, the rest of his credibility was destroyed by the British press. So there is a little bit of an overview on Constantine Simonides that we can at least begin this journey, gleaning this, to try to understand a little bit more about this man and this claim that he was the person who forged or was the author of the scribe of Codex Sinaiticus. So let's move on now and look at what D.C. Parker says about Simonides. And Parker, in this book on pages 151 and 152, is going to pretty strongly dismiss the allegation that Simonides was the person who created Codex Sinaiticus. He's going to say that this claim was an act of sheer chutzpah. So let me just look at it. This is on pages 151 and 152. Here's what Parker writes. He writes, the heading is Simonides. It is usual for forgers to pass off their work as that of another. It is rare for them to claim authorship of a genuine article. But, and one thing this book should have shown, is that Codex Sinaiticus is the kind of manuscript that attracts attention. This happened. The Manchester Guardian of 3 September 1862 contained a letter from one C. Simonides, in which he carefully set out the way in which he had made a copy of the Greek scriptures for presentation by his uncle Benedict, librarian of the monastery Ponteleimon on Mount Athos, to Tsar Nicholas I. He explains the details of how he did this, and of how the Patriarch of Constantinople persuaded him to present the manuscript to St. Catherine's, and of the Archbishop's letter of thanks for the gift, dated 13 August 1841. Of how, when he saw it in 1852, it was much altered, looking older than it should do, concluding that the above is a true statement of the origin and history of the famous Codex Sinaiticus, which Professor Tischendorf has foisted on the world as a manuscript of the 4th century. Finally explaining that the corrections were made by his uncle, one understands why a former Regius professor of Greek in the University of Oxford has described Simonides as, quote, a name indeed that deserves a whole page on the golden book of Chutzpah. Some of Simonides' forgeries, Parker continues, of Greek manuscripts had been accepted as genuine and landed him in prison when they were exposed. The absurdity of his claim to have forged something so indisputably the genuine article must be put down to malice. The fact that Tischendorf was one of those who had exposed Simonides early in 1856 may have had something to do with it. A few in the British press, at any rate, chose to take up the matter. A long defunct journal called the Literary Churchman actually took Simonides' side while claiming neutrality. In retrospect, it may seem surprising that anybody could have taken any of Simonides' letters seriously, but one has only to look at more recent cases to see that there is never a dearth of people willing to support a ridiculous claim. So Parker says this claim is ridiculous. The whole story that Simonides put forward in this letter to the Guardian about him having created this, his uncle having offered the corrections, and he had given it to St. Catherine's Monastery, and somehow it had aged to look older. Parker says this is just chutzpah. There is an interesting section in Parker's book on page 154 under sources and further reading where he gives a little bit of a bibliography. He says, for Simonides and chutzpah, see Peter Parsons' article, Forging Ahead, Has Simonides Struck Again, in the Times Literary Supplement, 22 February 2008. And the letter by Harris Caligus, 19 March of 2008. The episode is extensively documented by J.K. Eliot in his book Codex Sinaiticus and the Simonides Affair, an examination of the 19th century claim that Codex Sinaiticus was not an ancient manuscript. And this was published by the Patriarchal Institute for Patristic Studies in 1982, and I would say this is probably the go-to monograph if you really get interested in studying the claim of the Simonides forgery of Codex Sinaiticus, this work by J.K. Eliot, Codex Sinaiticus and the Simonides Affair. So we've looked at the Wikipedia article, we've looked at D.C. Parker, and he just, you know, rejects this as a matter of Simonides' chutzpah. A third source that I want to look at is this book written by Stanley E. Porter. And it's a biography of Constantine Tischendorf, who was the Western discoverer of Codex Sinaiticus and publisher of it. He claims to have found it within the monastery at St. Catherine's on Sinai. And so this is a biography, again, of Tischendorf. It's subtitled The Life and Work of a 19th Century Bible Hunter. And this was published by Bloomsbury in 2015. I read this. I was going to write a review of it. And I have never gotten around to writing a review of it. 5 years have passed. I probably won't write one. But I just looked in the at the back, at the index, to see, to remind myself of the references to Simonides. And there are two sections in this book where he talks about Tischendorf and his interactions with Simonides. The first of these is on pages 38 and 39 of the book, where Porter discusses how Simonides in 1855 sold to the University of Leipzig library manuscripts of the what purported to be the Shepherd of Hermas. And of course, the Shepherd of Hermas is also included in Codex Sinaiticus. And later, though, these documents that Simonides sold to the University of Leipzig, they were later challenged as being inauthentic by various scholars, including Tischendorf. Around the same time, Porter reports, Simonides was arrested on the charge of forging a palimpsest manuscript attributed to a man named Uranius, that's U-R-A-N-I-U-S, of Alexander. And this claimed to be an ancient historical document. And Porter notes that it was Tischendorf who was among those who wrote disputing the authenticity of this document, again, attributed to Uranius of Alexandria. So let me just read a little bit of this, and you can get a feel for what Porter is saying. He talked about a couple of important events that happened to Tischendorf, and he takes off here on page 38. The first event was in connection with the Shepherd of Hermas, and the second in relation to the Palimpsest manuscript relating to the history of the kings of Egypt by a person named Uranius of Alexandria. The stories, however, are interconnected and bear brief repeating. The Shepherd of Hermas is a work that has long been recognized as being highly popular in the ancient church. But it was only known in Latin versions at this point in Tischendorf's life. In 1855, however, a man by the name of Constantine Simonides, a name that will be mentioned again below, sold to the University of Leipzig library a manuscript. He said that it was a copy of the original Greek manuscript of the Shepherd of Hermas, except for a final page of the text. His manuscript consisted of three sheets, supposedly from a manuscript from Mount Athos, written in a 14th century hand, and six sheets purporting to be from the same manuscript, but written in Simonides' own hand, as he had been unable to secure the rest of the manuscript. The library quickly purchased the pages, and two classical scholars, Rudolf Anger and Wilhelm Dindorf, set about publishing them. So he sold six sheets to the University of Leipzig. Three of them claimed to be from a copy of the Shepherd of Hermas that was at Mount Athos. Six of the sheets were supposedly Simonides' own writing out of part of the manuscript that he wasn't able to secure, but he had his written transcription of it. Porter continues, Simonides was arrested at this time, being accused of forging the manuscript of Uranius mentioned above. So while he sold these manuscripts of the Shepherd of Hermas to the University of Leipzig, and these two German scholars accept it as authentic and are publishing it, but while this is going on, Parker says this was in 1856, so a year later, 1855, he sells the manuscripts to University of Leipzig. A year later, 1856, there's a charge that he has forged this work by Uranius of Alexandria. He continues, this is now page 39 of this book on Constantine Tischendorf. When arrested, Simonides also had another copy of the set of six sheets of the Shepherd of Hermas, which pages had a very different text on them than the pages sold to the University of Leipzig, with the version followed by Anger and Dindorf being apparently a corrected form of this one. So I don't know if you're following this, the plot deepens. So they arrest him and they find he's got another six sheets of the Shepherd of Hermas, but they're not the same as the ones that he sold to the University of Leipzig. They're different. Of course, he continues, the arrests of Simonides raised numerous questions about the authenticity of any of the manuscripts related to him. And a number of scholars got involved in the debate, including Tischendorf himself. After all, who better to comment on the veracity of ancient manuscripts than the man who examined more of them than any other human being? Tischendorf thought that the three sheets purportedly from Mount Athos reflected the translation into Greek of an earlier Latin versions of an earlier Latin version, rather singular, and that the later discovered six sheets were really made from the original at Mount Athos, whereas the earlier six sheets, now owned by the University of Leipzig, were Simonides' later construction. So Tischendorf's view was that the three sheets that Simonides claimed had come from Mount Athos were actually simply his rendering into Greek a Latin version, so they were not authentic. But he said the six sheets that were transcribed by Simonides, the ones that were found on him when he was arrested, were actually probably authentic transcriptions of an original, whereas the six he had sold to the University of Leipzig were his edited or reconstructed or corrected ones. It's a little bit complicated. Porter now continues, as we shall see below, Tischendorf was wrong on the first point regarding the three sheets, but probably correct on the second point concerning the six sheets. So Porter now says, and I won't read that part of the discussion, that actually the three sheets from the Shepherd of Hermas that Simonides claimed that he said were from Mount Athos from the 14th century were actually authentic. But Tischendorf was right, probably right, that the six sheets that he kept on him were transcriptions of some original of a text that Shepherd of Hermas that he had found at Mount Athos. All right, I hope this isn't too complicated and this is in the weeds. He says, as a result of Tischendorf's publication of his results in the form of an edition of the Shepherd of Hermas, Anger and Dindorf admitted that their edition was of no scholarly value. After that, a number of other scholars attempted to create their own editions of the Shepherd of Hermas, but the entire situation changed in 1859 when the rest of Sinaiticus was discovered, and then in 1863 when a new edition of the Shepherd of Hermas was published. In the meantime, because of his expertise in handwriting, Tischendorf became involved in the Uranius episode as well, which also involved Dindorf's initial attestation as to its authenticity, though the manuscript was later found to be a forgery. In this case, as in the previous one, Tischendorf also disputed the authenticity of the Uranius document by Simonides. So Tischendorf got involved and questioned the authenticity of the Uranius document, and I think that the consensus is that he was correct, that Simonides had forged this particular document. It's interesting that this poor scholar, German scholar, Dindorf, who had authenticated this, and then the whole scholarly consensus shifts, and he has to make a statement that, they were wrong in accepting this. They had accepted a forged document as authentic. So that's an interesting part of the discussion. Now, a little bit later in Porter's book, He deals with the Codex Sinaiticus controversy with Simonides. And I'm going to pick it up here again on pages 48 through 50 now. He says, two major issues remain to be dealt with in terms of Tischendorf and the Sinai Codex. The first revolves around Simonides, the forger whom we discussed previously. Frustrated with the outcome of his previous dealings with Tischendorf, Simonides was bold enough in around 1860 to start circulating the story that Codex Sinaiticus was in fact not the oldest manuscript, but instead a recent forgery. When Sinaiticus was published in 1862, Simonides wrote a letter to the Guardian newspaper in England, making the bold claim that he had written the manuscript himself in 1840. He created an elaborate story of how his uncle wished to give a gift to the Tsar and had decided that it would be an Old and New Testament manuscript written in ancient fashion. Simonides took on the task, he claimed, starting by finding an old bound codex with blank pages and then writing the text on it. This very same manuscript eventually ended up at St. Catherine's Monastery, where Tischendorf found it. The Germans largely ignored Simonides, but the English, perhaps somewhat out of suspicion of Germans and German scholarship, paid more attention to it. After all, this was around the time of the publication of Essays and Reviews, 1860, when German higher criticism was being more openly introduced and promoted in English scholarly circles, which resulted in numerous accusations and counter-accusations, some of them no doubt being ethnically oriented. Some of this attention was no doubt also because the English knew less of Simonides' history as a proven forger. Other attention may have been because of the appearance of Sinaiticus was seen to be a threat to some as it provided early readings of the biblical text, especially in the New Testament, that rejected some of those found in the Textus Receptus. So let me just pause here for a moment. So Porter's saying Simonides found out about Tischendorf getting all this praise for discovering Sinaiticus. Maybe he had an axe to grind with Tischendorf because of Tischendorf's exposure of the Uranus inauthenticity. And so he began to say, oh, I created that book. And I wrote that in 1840. He says that the German scholars, just dismissed it. They knew of Simonides, but the English, because of controversy over the introduction of what will be the modern historical critical method out of Germany and its export into England and a backlash of English traditionalists, they seized on this because they had suspicions about the whole modern critical text movement and its effort to unseat the Textus Receptus. Now he continues. It became clear to many, not least to Tischendorf himself, who had already edited a number of editions of the Greek New Testament, that Codex Sinaiticus tended, though not always, to follow a much earlier textual tradition for the Greek New Testament, and therefore did not include the long reigning of Mark or the story of the woman caught in adultery, two well-known passages among a number of others. Beloved by many, but clearly not found in the earliest manuscripts, including most obviously as the first major example published of such an early manuscript, Codex Sinaiticus. There may also have been some jealousy or hostility towards Tischendorf in light of a German making such a significant antiquarian discovery. Nevertheless, when the facts were all presented, Simonides was readily dismissed. On the one hand, there was the evidence of the manuscript itself, which a number of credible textual scholars besides Tischendorf endorse as being early, such as Samuel Tregellis. On the other hand, there was the total implausibility of Simonides' story. The reaction against him included, according to J.K. Eliot, drawing attention to the fact that, now, Porter here draws upon the work of Eliot that I mentioned previously, that's cited by Parker in the little bibliography. And so he's going to list 10 reasons why the Simonides forgery theory should be rejected. This is Porter drawing on J.K. Eliot. First, he, that is Simonides, had waited so long to come forward. If he had supposedly created Codex Sinaiticus, why didn't he come forward much earlier? Why did he only come forward in 1861 when he could have come forward much earlier when Tischendorf had first announced his discovery of it? Secondly, he had, according to the chronology he presented, copied the entire manuscript in 1 year. Is it possible he could have painstakingly done this work, this huge work, Codex Sinaiticus, in 1 year, among other duties and responsibilities he may have had? Third, he would have been only 15 when he had done this. This assumes a birth date of 1825 or 1824 for him, if he completed in 1840. Fourth, Simonides had not visited St. Catherine's when he said that he had. Fifth, he claims to have seen the pages found in Codex Frederico Augustanus at St. Catherine's after Tischendorf had already taken them away. So there were inconsistencies in Simonides' story. Sixth, the manuscript had more mutilations than its recent vintage would warrant. It had too many mutilations. It couldn't have been a recently created document and have this much damage done to it, basically. Seventh, the exemplars Simonides would have needed to copy from have never been identified. If Simonides copied Sinaiticus and created it, what did he use as his exemplar? Can he produce those? Eighth, the styles of writing and hands used in the manuscript would have been very difficult for one person to create. Because we've got Sinaiticus, we've got thousands of corrections made in it. How could he reproduce these hands? Nine, some of the textual markers, such as the Ammonian sections, were adopted, but not others. I'm not exactly sure what the line of argument is there. If it had a sort of a canon for navigating your way through the text, it's there in some sections and not in others. Not sure why that would be a mark against authenticity, but I'm sure Eliot expands upon that. And 10th and finally, he says, it is implausible that Simonides was not trying to deceive in creating the manuscript. It is implausible that Simonides was not trying to deceive in creating the manuscript. So what he's saying is Simonides' story is that he wasn't trying to create a forgery or deception. This was going to be a gift. And this was going to be a gift to the czar. If that was the case, then why did he create such a shoddy work as Codex Sinaiticus is notorious for many, corrections and errors within it? Let me complete now this, what the remainder of what Porter says. He says, Eliot reaches two reasonable and important conclusions. Quote, Tischendorf's judgment about the age, composition, and significance of Codex Sinaiticus were to remain without serious challenge, end quote. And, quote, ironically, had it not been for Simonides' attempt to cast doubt on Tischendorf's scholarly judgment, many scholars, especially in England, may not have been so interested in verifying the details about Sinaiticus or taken so much notice of the manuscript. So he says, Simonides' efforts to devalue, debunk Sinaiticus actually ended up sort of backfiring on him, and it ended up with more traditional English scholars looking at it and saying, at least, yeah, okay, it's from the fourth century, it's old, even if we don't accept the readings within it. In other words, rather than the Simonides affair harming Tischendorf, it led to greater recognition of the importance of the manuscript he had discovered and published. I'll pause right there. That'll be enough from reading from Porter. So that gives us, if we look at the Wikipedia article and we look at the Parker's brief statements and we look at Porter's drawing on Eliot, we get the basic outline of the story of the alleged forgery of Codex Sinaiticus at the hands of Constantine Simonides. So, what conclusions can we draw from this little survey. My sense is that Codex Sinaiticus may, I'll put that in italic, may be a forgery. But I believe it is more likely that it is authentic, that it does come from the fourth century, based on the arguments made by Eliot and relayed by Porter. There are people who are experts on papyrology. Tischendorf would have been an expert in his day. Tregelis would have been an expert in his day, and there are people who are experts in this day. There are those who have examined the manuscripts firsthand, not just in digital copies. And I do think that their judgment should be given proper weight. So Sinaiticus may be possibly could have been created by Simonides, but I think it's not very probable. It's not very likely, given the arguments, again, made by Eliot. That's not to say, however, that scholars cannot be duped. They can be. We know they can be. One of the most foolish things that is said sometimes is that, you know, modern scholars just look at things neutrally and they don't come with any presuppositions. Well, that's balderdash. Of course they do. And sometimes they can be misled by dubious evidence that they accept. Not because of scientific inquiry or neutrality, but because it supports their viewpoint. And so Sinaiticus may be a forgery. It's probably not, but we shouldn't dismiss the fact that scholars can be misled. And I was just thinking about that, and I was thinking about some of the more contemporary examples of disputes about the authenticity of documents. And I want to just note briefly sort of three contemporary examples of this. And let me see if I can draw up this so you can see it. So the first one I want to consider is a dispute that was created in around the year 1958 regarding the Columbia scholar Morton Smith and what is called the Secret Gospel of Mark. I'm just going to pull up the Wikipedia article on this. So the dispute here involved the authenticity of a letter. It's called the Mar Saba letter, discovered in a monastery in Jerusalem, that was attributed to the early ecclesiastical writer Clement of Alexandria. And it makes reference to an extended version of the Gospel of Mark. And you can read the Wikipedia article. The original letter was lost, but there was only Smith's transcription of it. And eventually, most people came to the conclusion that this document was false. And even some came to the conclusion that Morton Smith had created this himself. And he published a book on this, and he was so desperate to find, you know, unique information that there's a good chance he created it himself. And so this would be a contemporary example of a disputed inauthentic document that was passed off as something that was authentic. So we shouldn't think that Simonides was the only one with chutzpah. In answer to D.C. Parker. Second example I want to give is a more recent one, and this relates to Dan Wallace of Dallas Seminary and the so-called first century Mark. And this was a dispute that took place in 2012 when Dan Wallace was debating Bart Ehrman. Oh my goodness, he debated Bart Ehrman. He went into the ring with Bart Ehrman. Oh, I thought James White was the only one who could do that. But actually, Dan Wallace debating Bart Ehrman is kind of like James White debating Bart Ehrman. They really don't have anything to disagree on. They're both reasoned, eclectic scholars, but the only thing they would disagree on is that Wallace, as an evangelical, would still believe there's some inspiration and authority to the New Testament writings. But in the course of that debate, Dan Wallace famously made reference to a supposed recent papyrus find of Mark that dated it to the first century. And he put this forward to prove the antiquity of the Gospel of Mark, and that it was close to the time of Jesus, and therefore it was an authentic historical record of the life of Jesus and so forth. The problem was that there was a challenge as to whether or not this document could actually be dated to the first century. And in fact, a few years after this, finally, the papyrus in question was published, and it turns out that it was not dated to the first century, but it was dated sometime in the second or third century. And in 2018, then Dan Wallace had to issue an apology. And this is what he wrote. He said, "In my debate with Bart, I mentioned that I had it on good authority that this was definitely a first century fragment of Mark, a representative for who I understood was the owner of FCM, First Century Mark, urged me to make the announcement at the debate, which they realized would make this go viral. However, the information I received and was assured to have been vetted was incorrect. It was my fault for being naive enough to trust the data I got was unquestionable as it was presented to me. So I must first apologize to Bart Ehrman and to everyone else for giving misleading information about this discovery. While I am sorry for publicly announcing inaccurate facts, at no time in the public statements, either in the debate or on my blog site, did I knowingly do this, but I should have been more careful about trusting any sources without my personal verification, a lesson I have since learned." And I think probably Dan Wallace, although, clearly he was in the wrong in claiming first century Mark, I think probably he got respect from some people for his ability to apologize and to acknowledge that he had been wrong. And, you know, apply what he just said to the question about is Codex Sinaiticus authentic or not. I wonder if you were to ask that question to Dan Wallace using what he said here about first century Mark, whether he would have to claim, "I can't say so," because unless he had extensively studied all of Sinaiticus himself, and maybe he's done so, I don't know. So the third example I want to point to is another contemporary one. And this relates to a fragment of a supposedly Coptic early manuscript that is referred to as the Gospel of Jesus's Wife. And there was a scholar, there is a scholar who teaches at Harvard Divinity School, Karen L. King, who published and claimed that she had found this fragment that made reference to Jesus having a wife. And this was circulated around the year 2012. But then a few years later in 2016, this papyrus was proven to be a forgery. There was a celebrated article that was written in the Atlantic magazine by Ariel Sabar, June 2016, and King eventually conceded that the evidence, as she put it, now presses in the direction of forgery. So I give you those examples just to sort of illustrate that there's a whole history of scholars accepting dubious material. Did Constantine Tischendorf accept dubious material in accepting the authenticity of Codex Sinaiticus? Simonides said he did. I think it's probably less likely, but certainly it can happen in these three earlier illustrations that I've given, whether it's Morton Smith or Dan Wallace with First Century Mark or Karen King with the Gospel of Jesus' Wife illustrate that. The warning here is this: scholars can make overblown and even deceptive claims about manuscripts in order to support their presuppositions, to support their viewpoint, their points, just as traditionalists can do to support theirs. Maybe traditionalists have been overzealous in arguing for the inauthenticity of Codex Sinaiticus, perhaps. the three examples, contemporary examples that I cited are all examples that involve relatively short and fragmentary documents, whether it's the Morton Smith's fragment of a letter from Clement of Alexandria, or first century Mark papyrus, or this Coptic fragment supposedly that mentions Jesus having a wife. One of the arguments in favor, I think, of the authenticity of Codex Sinaiticus would be the fact that it's not simply a small fragment. It's a massive document, and it shows, as I mentioned, evidence of a lot of scribal correction. And so I think that's an argument that tips the scales of probability against Codex Sinaiticus being a forged document, being inauthentic. But I don't think we can say 100% that it isn't either. The claim can't be completely dismissed. At the least, the dispute about the authenticity of Codex Sinaiticus illustrates, I think, a glaring weakness in the modern historical critical reconstruction method. If you're going to rely on the attempt to reconstruct the New Testament text based on gathering together the extant evidence, if that's the method that you're going to rely on, you have to do so without knowing with absolute certainty about the provenance or the origins of most of the documents that you're going to gather together to do your reconstruction. And so there's always going to be a measure of lack of certainty about the authenticity of the document that you have reconstructed. And so it's another weakness, I think, in the reconstruction method. And the whole Simonides claim of Sinaiticus being a forgery, I think, is just an example of that. And that's why I prefer that the text that we use is the received text, the text that was printed during the Protestant Reformation, the text that was the basis for the modern vernacular translation, the text that has been preached and taught and received by Protestant Christians since the time of the Reformation. Well, I hope that this Word Magazine 186 has been helpful. I hope this discussion of the possibility of Codex Sinaiticus as a forgery has been helpful, just to give us some historical background to it. I'm looking forward, if I don't watch it live, I probably won't watch it live since it's going to be late on the Lord's Day, but I'll probably watch or listen to the conversation between James White and Stephen Avery later when it's posted online. So maybe that'll be interesting, and maybe this discussion will give some background to help us understand better the conversation that will take place then. Again, I hope this has been helpful. I wish you God's richest blessings as we come to the end of 2020 and as we're on the threshold of 2021. And I will look forward, God willing, to presenting more Word magazines in the new year. Look forward to speaking to you in the next Word magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.